This is CSAP's Science and Policy Podcast from the University of Cambridge, where we're bringing you the latest evidence and expertise to improve public policymaking. Hi, I'm Rob Doubleday, host of CSAP's Science and Policy Podcast. This week, we are proud to present the first episode of our new series on science policy and a green recovery. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome Emily Shuckburgh, Rebecca Willis, and Dimitri Zengalis. Emily is director of Cambridge Zero, which is the University of Cambridge's big effort to bring together its research, teaching, engagement to tackle the challenge of climate change, and also to work to reduce its own footprint. Rebecca Willis is a professor at the University of Lancaster. Her research focuses on climate politics, and she's been a lead expert to the recent Climate Assembly UK. So that's a citizens assembly that's brought together over 100 people representative of the UK population at large, called together by six select committees of the House of Commons with the task of considering a range of options and coming up with some proposals to tackle climate change. And finally, Dimitri Zengalis, who is a lead researcher on the Wealth Economy Project at the Bennett Institute for Public Policy at Cambridge University. He's also a senior visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. You're all very welcome. Thank you. In the first season of the podcast, earlier this year, we looked at some of the immediate challenges posed by the pandemic. We looked at some of the health responses and ways that government were reacting quickly to deal with the crisis. In this second series, we're starting to look at some of the longer term effects. We want to think about how the economic shock is going to create new opportunities and challenges for government, and particularly in the light of questions of climate change, biodiversity loss, and other environmental challenges that governments are facing. We want to talk to a range of academics from different disciplines about how they see the current challenge, what the opportunities are, and what role universities can play. Emily, how would you say that the pandemic is reshaping the conversation about climate policy?
I think that probably the pandemic has raised both challenges and opportunities, and those are probably different in different countries of the world. But I would say that at least from sitting within the UK, the challenge obviously is that we're in challenging economic times. But the opportunity, I think, is that this has provided somewhat of a reset moment, a moment at which, because everything has been thrown up in the air by the pandemic, it provides an opportunity to evaluate everything and to evaluate whether or not it is set up to be resilient and sustainable into the future. Those questions have been asked because of the current pandemic, but they are exactly the questions to be asking in the context of climate change as well. And so I think it has opened up the potential to have a conversation that might be more difficult to have in other circumstances. And there seems to be, in this country at least, pretty widespread consensus around the idea that this is the time to start building back from the pandemic in a way that supports a green future.
So, Dimitri, we've just heard from Emily, who talked about the current pandemic as a reset moment. So normal rules suspended, things are thrown up in the air, and we can think of this as an opportunity. But of course, it's also a huge economic shock. Mm. What does it mean in terms of the kind of economic situation that governments are facing, and how does that constrain what's possible?
I think from an economic perspective, it's probably best to think of this in terms of two parts to the story. The first is rescue. You're in this unusual position where you're actively trying to slow the economy down by limiting people's social and economic interactions. So it doesn't really make sense to be simultaneously stimulating it and stopping it. So the rescue plan is very much about keeping businesses, keeping jobs in kind of suspended animation so that when we're out of this, they can pick up where they left off. The second part is recovery. That comes after the rescue and comes after we've got to a point where the pandemic is under control. A key question here is, once you're recovering, what kind of world are you trying to build? And is it the same world that you previously had before the pandemic? And partly there's been a sense that we don't want to go back to that world. And partly the pandemic has already forced a number of changes in the way we do things. And that also begs the question, do you want to preserve jobs and do you want to preserve skills and companies in sectors that maybe don't have the same opportunities or don't even have a future? future in this new economy. That's an economy that not only needs to be resilient to pandemics, it's got to be resilient to the onslaught of new technologies, AI, big data, digitization, and all the rest of it, and the fact that we're going to have to live in a, you know, resource and climate constrained world.
Rebecca, how did the onset of the pandemic influence discussions of the Climate Assembly?
The COVID lockdown hit three quarters of the way through Climate Assembly UK. Climate Assembly brought together 108 people who were between them perfectly representative of the UK as a whole. They'd spent three weekends talking about what the path to net zero should look like. And then the world changed. And we had a pause, obviously, because we couldn't meet anymore. And we were moving online and we were talking to the participants about that. But what became really clear is that they wanted to talk about those COVID climate links. So we moved things around and we did talk about those links. And actually the responses were much stronger than I'd imagined. In two areas. The first was that they felt really strongly that COVID recovery had to be aligned with net zero goals. And obviously in terms of, you know, a green economic stimulus, but also in terms of not giving money out to big polluters. And the other area was around what you might call behaviour or lifestyle change. And there, a bit of an opportunity space had opened up for people. Things were so different that they were willing to contemplate, you know, doing things differently in the future. And they showed their support for that. But also their attitudes towards government had changed a bit. And I think going back to the very essence of what government is, it's to do collectively what we can't do individually. And the pandemic had really brought that out for people.
Dimitri, is there anything you'd like to add?
On the behavioural side, we've already seen a lot of changes in behaviour, which could be potentially both kind of positive in terms of productivity positive behaviours, but also climate and sustainability positive behaviours. You know, some people will argue that we've seen 6 years of innovation in the space of 6 months. The virtualization of things, the importance of connected technology, the fact that we're seeing a spread of virtualization into areas such as healthcare and learning and security. You know, all of this is changing the way we interact economically. Better use of urban space, you know, reclaiming streets, reducing congestion, and all this sort of stuff is very welcome, increased localization. But there are some elements which are quite troubling. For example, evidence across the world that people are shifting from public transport to cars. And this really does testify to the need for policy intervention to do things like preserve public transport capacity, even as revenues fall. Because the last thing we want, if we're to live within our resource and carbon envelope, is sprawling cities that are hollowed out. The world is rapidly urbanizing and we need to retain the benefits of compact connected cities.
So where do we go from here?
Well, I mean, the challenge on climate change is that, you know, unfortunately, it requires action across so many different dimensions. It's pretty difficult to describe any real prioritizations. You know, in a way, you can look at this as a, you know, project delivery. There's a, you know, the country is now signed up to reach net zero emissions by 2050. So we've got a clear endpoint that we need to reach. And so how do we manage that project that has multiple different dimensions in it with multiple different sub priorities and milestones and ambitions across different sectors? And it feels as though unless you have some kind of, you know, treat it a bit like a project plan in that sense, then you do scramble around saying, where do I even start? Where should my priorities be? One of the models that quite a number of people have been suggesting is looking at to the way in which the London 2012 Olympics were delivered. And is there a role for some kind of delivery board that spans different government departments, but not just different government departments, but also crucially reaches down into local government as well?
Becky, did the Climate Assembly bring to the table any ideas on how to take action? What should be prioritised?
So I think, I mean, looking across, I mean, the Assembly considered transport, aviation, food and farming, energy use in the home, a whole host of issues. But one of the interesting things that was common across those themes was a really clear need for government leadership. And it's interesting because it actually came out in the same week as the Institute for Government's report on governance for net zero, and very similar findings from our 108 citizens in terms of wanting a much clearer pathway between here and 2050, much clearer leadership, a sense of us being in this together, citizens and government, clear communication both ways. But they were really clear that it would only work if it was, you know, seen as a partnership between citizen and state, if it was something that everyone understood the reasons for, could see what was coming and could, you know, could see the advantages, not just to climate, but to their own lives and to their local towns and high streets and so on.
Given the argument that rescue and then recovery from the current crisis is an opportunity, and the fact that citizens given a chance to deliberate these questions, at least in the UK, seem keen for that opportunity to be grasped, I'm interested in what we think the likelihood of government being able to act to take advantage of those opportunities are. I mean, Dimitri, from an economic point of view, and then Becky, perhaps from a political point of view.
It would be a missed opportunity if we went back and locked into the kind of unsustainable and unequal, unfair and vulnerable activities that we've indulged in the past. There is a fiscal problem, which you're doubtless aware of, which I think has to be confronted when people talk about the public's response. You know, we've already seen this unprecedented public response to the global pandemic, which has pushed public debt levels in most countries to kind of historic highs relative to world output. At the same time, we need more fiscal activism to, you know, expand capacity to invest. And also, and I'm sorry if this sounds a little bit sort of, you know, geeky, but also it's in recognition of the rather limited scope for monetary policy in supporting global growth. We, you know, monetary policy has been pushed to its limits and real interest rates are now negative. It's not clear how much further they can go. So there's going to be further rises in public debt to GDP. And this has, you know, led to kind of, you know, concerns about potential limits of fiscal space. Because over the long run, if you've got high debt to GDP, public debt to GDP, it does increase your vulnerability to future debt crises. The bottom line on this, and I think it's really important to emphasize this, is that the only way to bring down public debt to GDP is to concentrate on sustained expansion in GDP. We've never managed it any other way. If we focus on budget deficits through austerity, it tends to end up being counterproductive. And if you look at the history of debt to GDP in most advanced economies, the only periods they've come down significantly over long and sustainably is over periods of high growth. So if you invest in the right things to stimulate growth, and that includes a sustainable, clean economy that's resilient to 21st century pressures, you increase the possibility and the opportunity to reduce your debt to GDP levels and therefore achieve debt sustainability far, far more effective than fixating on budget deficits.
Becky, is there anything you'd like to add from the point of view of the politics?
Climate strategy boils down to, I mean, probably four things which are really simple to say and really hard to do. The first is stop burning fossil fuels. The second thing is keep fossil fuels in the ground. The third thing is sort out your land use so that you're managing land for greenhouse gases. And the last thing is to prepare for what's coming in terms of climate impact. All of those, apart from preparing, we know how to do. You know, we've got the technical know-how to do those. I don't think we have on preparedness, by the way. I think we're way behind the curve on that. But on the first three, we know what to do, and the challenge is political. And once you get into some of the politics around that, like, for example, the politics of keeping fossil fuel in the ground, it then becomes really difficult. So, you know, I've been following the coal mine which is proposed in Cumbria. And there you've got a complete division between those people who want jobs at any cost, even if it means opening a coal mine that will, spew out 9 million tonnes of carbon a year for 50 years. And those that are willing to say, no, these are the wrong jobs. We want different sorts of jobs. We're prepared to say no to these jobs because it's not right for the climate and it's not right for our local area. That's a complete division now. And I think that's where the politics is moving. It's to some of these, you know, really tricksy questions around implementation.
And how do you think that, I mean, thinking about the United Kingdom, I mean, that then all course intersects with questions about devolution and the scale at which these decisions are going to be taken.
So, you know, one of the recommendations we put is that the government should try and build on the Cities and Local Government Devolution Act and provide more financial and policy autonomy to cities and regions, which are better placed to address local infrastructure, skills and sustainability challenges. That's one of the institutional changes. Others include, you know, revamping your institutions to be more focused on the long term and investing on things like very simple, you know, institutions like a national investment bank with a strong sustainability mandate.
Yeah, another pretty strong theme coming out from assembly findings, and we didn't ask them this directly, it was another one of those things that sort of bubbled up throughout their discussions, was wanting essentially a devolved approach to climate action, but they didn't call it that, but they were very keen on responsibility and resources going to local areas to manage transport strategies, to manage local energy planning, all that kind of thing, and quite a reaction against national level policies that they felt would be imposed from London, and very interesting conversations between citizens about, you know, how local areas were different and how circumstances might be different. But also, you know, it makes sense to make this stuff sort of locally specific. So I also think it's really important to distinguish between cities and essentially the rest of the country, because the political battlegrounds aren't actually the cities. They are, you know, the classic red wall seats, which tend to be, you know, smaller cities, larger towns, those kinds of areas. And local government in those areas is drastically under-resourced and actually under-skilled. If you look at the county or district level or those smaller towns, they've really got nothing to play with, and it will, if we are actually going to equip them to engage in a really sort of forward-thinking way in building a local green economy, that is going to mean a huge upskilling and resourcing of those sub-city levels. And, you know, that's a big change from what we've got at the moment.
Providing opportunities for some of these smaller towns does not come at the expense of providing opportunities for some of the larger cities outside London. I think if Leeds and Manchester were able to have a degree of autonomy to attract a lot of new businesses to the point where they can provide high-paid jobs as London does, then I think a lot of the towns around them, which would benefit quite substantially.
I'm doing some research at the moment, talking to local government officials and politicians about what happens next. And they honestly do not know. They really want to do this stuff, but they don't have the resources, they don't have the powers, and their existing sort of administrative structures just aren't set up for it.
What about at a national level? What investments should governments be making, and how should investment in climate-friendly initiatives be incentivized?
An interesting element, we undertook a survey where we actually surveyed about 230 kind of leading finance ministry, central bank and senior economists, not the usual, you know, environmental suspects, not tree huggers by any means. And we asked them to rank the policies and investments that they thought would deliver growth and the policies and investments that they thought would deliver climate action. One of the interesting things that came out of this is they found that a lot of the policies which deliver growth are also the ones which deliver climate action, or vice versa. So things like clean R&D spending, clean energy infrastructure, connectivity infrastructure, building upgrades, energy efficiency, but also investment in green spaces. Now, 10 years ago, there was a sense that you either focus on investing in growth or you focus on investing in green. One of the interesting things now is that there is a general acceptance that actually the two not only can coexist together, but indeed one is a necessary condition for the other. And that does require a more active state. It's not just spending money. It's about the right policy frameworks. It's about the right institutions. But investment clearly has to be a key part of it. And a lot of that money is going to be private money, but it requires a clear lead and a credible lead from government.
That's very, very interesting. And Becky, can I bring you in here? Because I know that you've spent quite a number of years talking to MPs, talking to politicians about how they think about climate change and what role they think, you know, government needs to play, and what kind of room to maneuver they feel they have.
I mean, things have changed so much over the past 3 years. Firstly, because, you know, climate has shot up the political agenda much quicker than I've ever seen in all the time I've worked on this. And it has become something that, you know, kind of macho swaggering politicians do want to talk about. I mean, you know, look at Boris Johnson's Build Back Better speech. That's a real indication of the fact that it's you know, something politicians feel there's political capital in talking about now. And that has changed, because when I first started doing this research, there was much more reluctance, and there was a feeling that talking about climate was going to mark you out as, you know, a freak or a zealot, quite strong language used. I don't think that's true anymore of the headline issues. You know, I think now the thing to do is to stake out your claim on the climate agenda. I don't think that is yet translating into actual change at the next level down, at the sort of strategic or policy level.
Taking a step back for a second to look at political questions more broadly, climate change is often cast as an issue for the left. Why do you think that is? And is this something that can be changed going forward?
I mean, at a very philosophical level, there are two elements that make climate action more compatible with left-wing ideologies. The first is that it, one way or another, it involves a lot of market failures, which rely on policy intervention. And that often is something that conservatives don't like. It's bigger government, or at least more government to some extent. It involves regulations and standards and so on. I mean, the other element is that, you know, a lot of sort of fundamental conservative ideology is averse to change. It's about the wisdom of doing things the way we've always done things. And of course, a lot of this sort of new economy evangelism is about quite substantial and fundamental, profound change. And I think that can often sit uncomfortably with people who, you know, would class themselves as natural conservatives. On the other hand, there is something very conservative about the notion of sustainability. Just as you might think of sort of fiscal conservatism being about not spending beyond your means, in a very similar way, not trashing the environment is something that does, I think, adhere to fundamental conservative values. And I think right now there's a bit of a synthesis where we realize we're both trashing the environment, but we also recognize that the survival of right-wing parties does depend on a fairer distribution and a degree of public intervention to support the economy amongst not, you know, just a sort of narrow quadrant of the elites, but sort of more generally, both regionally and across income and wealth divides, which requires a bit more government. So, you know, maybe that is a nice place to be. I think the American example is a slightly kind of, you know, it's an unfortunate one, because you've got historical Republican skepticism, but you've got this sort of populist president who claims to be in favor of intervention and infrastructure and all the rest of it, but maybe has failed to deliver on that front.
Dimitri, I think, you know, the two reasons you gave for why climate is a harder issue for the right, essentially worries about intervention and a kind of fear of change or wanting to keep things as they are. That's what's so interesting about our current moment, isn't it? Because both of those things have gone out the window anyway because of COVID. And we've seen, you know, over the last 6 months, we've seen, you know, the most top-down state intervention imaginable by a right-wing government. And we've also seen huge amounts of change. So that's again why it's such an interesting moment. And I think that you're right, climate is an interventionist agenda, but I think what might be going on the right now, in some quarters anyway, is a sort of rebranding of intervention. And if that can work for climate as well as COVID, then that's a real opportunity.
I think
the bigger fear on the right is actually the right splitting between essentially sort of, you know, centre-right industrial strategy on the one hand, and then, you know, populist right, because it's very clear if you look around the world that right-wing populism is associated with climate denial.
I want to move on to bring back one more specific sort of area of policy. And Dimitri, I'm interested in your views on skills, because obviously one important issue is for those people who will be entering the labour market over the next year or two. You know, that's a big policy question. How will that transition into the labour market work for people finishing school or finishing college now? And how do we think about skills and climate change?
Yeah, so it's absolutely fundamental that a big part of this sort of building back better agenda is about investment in human capital, not just the sort of physical stuff. So in other words, the skills and the jobs necessary for a 21st century resilient economy. That means retooling and reskilling workers, enabling those affected by change to participate in the new economy. And, you know, that obviously that fits up with the government's levelling up agenda here. But it's also about change in general. It's not just climate, you know, it's all the digitization, AI, Internet of Things, big data, that whole kind of onslaught of new technologies, which will change the economy of the 21st century. But I think with regard to sustainability and climate, I think, you know, one idea that I think could be carried out is a requirement that all academic courses and vocational training should be given a sustainability ranking in terms of their compatibility with meeting sustainability targets. So it could be, for example, a temperature scale. How compatible are you with what stabilization temperature? And then students, pupils, people seeking training can choose to opt in or opt out on those courses and take their own view as to which are likely to be more profitable skills and more profitable ideas in the kind of economy we're likely to face in the 21st century, which is going to be increasingly carbon constrained, which is going to face hostile policies, which is going to be all about new, efficient, low carbon technologies. Do they want to enroll on courses which focus on the old economy, or do they want to focus on courses, enroll on courses which focus on the new economy? And I think, you know, having some kind of benchmarking system would be a really powerful way to allow people to vote with their feet in terms of what economy they want to invest in terms of their human capital.
That raises the question, Dimitri, who is going to do the benchmarking? Because, you know, you're talking about sort of trying to hit a moving target, which is going to require some judgment, some expertise to say, you know, what are the jobs of tomorrow going to be? So you're putting a lot of power in the hands of people doing the benchmarking.
Absolutely right. And, you know, that's a big question. You could leave it to students to do it themselves. And of course, you know, there's a degree of sort of subjectivity and qualitative assessment involved in this. But I think the very act of trying to think about these things and debate them and try and find some sort of benchmarking system could deliver.
The skills question comes back in part to the need for a much clearer and more confident articulation of the net zero strategy. You know, it comes back to what the Climate Assembly was saying they wanted in terms of leadership from government.
Finally, just before we wrap up, what role do you think universities have to play in taking leadership on climate action?
There are, in fact, very many ways, probably more ways than one might have initially imagined, in which the resources of the university can be deployed to support a global move, to rapid move to a zero carbon future. There's a lot of resources. Obviously, there's all the research side of the university. The university obviously also plays an absolutely central role in terms of education, and that's not just education of our students, but it's also other forms of educating the wider public. And then there's our external engagements with policymakers through CSAP and other initiatives, as well as all the activities that go on in the university in terms of industrial partnerships or entrepreneurial activities. And then finally, there's the university's own decarbonisation itself as well. And so what we've been doing is looking at where we can identify exemplar projects that we could really use as kind of flagships, but more importantly, as beacons for others to be able to follow.
I'm noticing, not universities so much, but in terms of the role of academics, I'm noticing a big shift that both in terms of natural scientists and people working in, you know, policy and governance, technology, engineering, and so on. I think there was always, previously, there has been this idea of, you know, the neutral academic, or, you know, not wanting to pick sides, not wanting to be too much of an activist or campaigner. And I think that's really shifted.
This is a time of fundamental and profound change, change in behaviours, change in institutions, change in technologies. And of course, you know, innovation is the only way we're going to square this circle. You know, a big part of the sustainability and growth story is about getting more out of the resources that we have by using them more cleverly. And of course, that means research, that means understanding the nature of change, it means understanding the risks as they happen. And a lot of that's going to rely increasingly on, you know, the findings of academics and their ability to communicate those findings, as, you know, we are doing right now, to those who can make policy choices. So a world of rapid change, I think, is one where, you know, at least on the face of it, you know, universities have an increasingly powerful role, not just to provide the analysis, but to present it in a way that motivates the right kind of change before it's too late.
So thank you for joining me today. It's been a really fascinating discussion that's opened up a lot of important issues that we're going to follow up in the coming series, looking at the green recovery as an opportunity to build back better, drawing on expertise from a wide range of disciplines. So we'll look forward to following up. CSAP's Science and Policy Podcast is a production of the Centre for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge. This series is produced in partnership with Cambridge Zero. This episode was hosted by me, Rob Doubleday, and was produced by Kate McNeil. Our guests this week were Emily Shuckburgh, Rebecca Willis, and Dimitri Zengalis. You can learn more about CSAP's work by visiting us on Twitter at CSIPOL or at our website, www.csap.cam.ac.uk. If you have any feedback about this episode or questions you'd like us to address in a future week, please email inquiries@csap.cam.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.